Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this meeting of Midlothian Council, which will be broadcast live to the internet. I'd like to remind everyone present that this meeting will be broadcast live to the internet, will be stored as part of the Council's webcast archive, and will be capable of repeated viewing. I have the discretion to terminate or suspend filming if, in my opinion, allowing filming to continue would prejudice the proceedings of the meeting. Equally so, items that are heard in private or items whereby the publication of the webcast may interfere with the debate, then these areas of the webcast will not be made available to the public. Members are reminded that the cameras are activated by the sound system and they must switch on microphones when speaking and off when finished speaking. And may I remind people in the public benches that if the member in front of you is speaking, then you will also be on camera. I have to welcome a few people from ScotRail, James Ledgerwood, Lindley Kirkpatrick and Andy Miller, and from Grant Thompson we have Paul Dossett. Is that correct? Okay. Could you tell us the order of business, Clark? Oh, sorry. Any apologies? I noticed there was no members missing, so...
Thanks, Provost. I have apologies from the Reverend Ruth Halley.
Okay. Thank you. The order of business?
And the order of business is as per the agenda that's been circulated with the following amendments. The Provost has agreed that the presentation is to be given by ScotRail and the external auditor. Items 8.1 and 8.2 on the agenda will be heard after item 6, i.e. after questions to the Leader. The Provost has further agreed that a counter-motion that was circulated to members yesterday, moved by Councillor Montgomery and seconded by Councillor Imrie, will be heard as part of the discussion of item 7.1. An emergency motion moved by Councillor Bennett and seconded by Councillor Parry, circulated to members this morning, will be heard as item 7.3. A further emergency notice of motion moved by Councillor Johnson and seconded by Councillor Coventry, circulated to members this morning, will be heard as item 7.4. And the Provost has further agreed that an additional paper submitted and circulated to members yesterday will be heard as part of the discussion for item 9.2. Thank you.
Thank you. Members should declare any financial or non-financial interest they have in the items of business for consideration, identifying the relevant agenda item and the nature of their interest. Should it come up during the item, please declare. We have the minutes of previous meetings, minutes of the meeting submitted for approval as a correct record, note of the meeting of Midlothian Council of 27 September 2016. Councillor Milligan.
Provost, thank you. Provost, not only be a long delay, just to say that we're happy to agree the base of the minute, but I would like to just raise a few problems that I have with the standing orders area. Number one, we did say at the last meeting that we would like a reconvening of the short life working group just to go over the exact details, because we still see some minor corrections that need to be done, and I raised these with the legal manager yesterday, and I think he accepts most of them. But one of the areas that we would like clarity on here just now is when Councillor Montgomery put in his amendment to one of the motions today, he was told that that was a counter motion that had to be in 24 hours beforehand. I didn't see that at all as that. I see that as what was put in was being an amendment, and I would expect elected members around this table would be really concerned if we couldn't move to amend any of the recommendations set out in papers here at any meeting after debate and listening to what officers had to say. And we'd just like maybe the monitoring officer to clarify what the position is on that area, and perhaps we need to address what is seen as a counter motion as to an amendment to a paper.
Mr. Turpey.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I can confirm that, and perhaps it's part of the course for being a solicitor, I took an overly cautious approach when Councillor Montgomery spoke to me. The new standing orders have a procedure under Standing Order 8.4 regarding counter motions, and the safest way to ensure that Councillor Montgomery's proposed amendments to the motion were heard were to include it as a counter-motion. Now, we have counter-motions under 8.4, and there's always the power for members to make amendments to motions. We don't have a custom practice in place yet to deal with the fact we've got counter-motions in one standing order and we've got the power to make amendments to motions on the other. So I think that's something that could be sorted out through Councillor Milligan's proposal for a resetting of the Short Life Working Group to look at that. Obviously, where people are looking simply to add or adjust to the motion, then that would still be done by an amendment. If they're looking to change the direction of travel completely, then that perhaps is something looked at as a counter-motion. I think if we can, Councillor Montgomery's proposals for the motion can be considered today, then that solves that problem, and we can then look at the Short Life Working Group to come up with proposals that will help us go forward with the motions, if that's acceptable to the members.
Okay. Thank you. Can we have a proposer and seconder for the minutes of that meeting? Councillor Parry and Councillor Constable. Thank you. Minutes of the meeting for noting and consideration of any recommendations. Meeting of the Cabinet of the 30th August 2016. Okay. Private meeting of Cabinet of the 30th of August 2016. Meeting of the Special Cabinet on 30th August 2016. Meeting of the Audit Committee of the 21st of June 2016. Meeting of Local Review Body of the 7th of June 2016. Meeting of the Local Review Body of 6th September 2016. Meeting of the Planning Committee of the 31st of May 2016. Meeting of the General Purposes Committee on the 24th of May 2016. A meeting of the General Purposes Committee of the 24th of May 2016. Meeting of the General Purposes Committee of the 23rd of August 2016. Meeting of the General Purposes Committee of 23rd of August 2016. Meeting of the Petitions Committee, 24th of March 2016. I'm assuming that's supposed to be. It says 2014 here. I think that's a misprint. Yes, okay. Thank you. We now move to the public reports, item number 8. I will hand you over to the Chief Executive, Kenneth Laurie.
Thank you, Provost. The Council received a report about Borders Rail at its last meeting, and on the back of that, committed to significant additional resources to take forward a series of projects relating to Borders Rail. At that stage, members also expressed some of their concerns about operational matters associated with the railway and requested that, as Chief Executive, I maintain an ongoing dialogue with ScotRail about these matters. So following that, I thought it would be appropriate to give ScotRail the opportunity to present an update, members, today. I'm very grateful to James Ledgerwood, Andy Miller and Lindley Kirkpatrick for agreeing to present to the Council, and I'll simply hand over to the colleagues from ScotRail, Provost.
Provost, ladies and gentlemen, councillors, thank you very much for inviting us along this afternoon. We are conscious you've got a busy agenda, so we will try and be focused on this presentation. If I can introduce to my right Andy Miller. Andy Miller's our Head of Integrated Performance with ScotRail, and he's been with the company for, he tells me, over 32 years. So Andy's very familiar with a number of the challenges that running a rail industry can perform. My colleague behind me, who many of you may know, is Lindley Kirkpatrick. Lindley is the Borders Programme Executive, and I'll touch a wee bit more on the role and the work of Lindley as we go through. What I'd like to do is remind people and set some context of the rail industry in Scotland and where the Borders Railway sits within that. We currently, on an annual basis, move 93 million passengers per annum and operate more than 2,300 services a day. Within the ScotRail Alliance, which is Abellio, ScotRail and Network Rail, we have over 7,000 staff and we're responsible for 358 stations and over 2,800 kilometres of track. And the projections are that those passenger journeys are only going to increase. So that equates to over a third of an increase up until the point of 2025. So it's very important for us that we are very clear about the vision and how we are going to successfully deliver on Scotland's railway. And I think this vision is very applicable to the Borders Railway. It is about connecting people with jobs, about connecting businesses with customers, tourists with destinations, and with opportunities for our communities to grow and prosper. And I don't think there's any line where that isn't more applicable. I'd like to just touch upon our first year in numbers. This is the largest public contract in Scotland, and Dobello ScotRail, and we're very proud to be operating that, and we're very committed to operating a successful railway. In our first year, we had over 130 committed obligations, which is the largest number that there's ever been with a railway franchise. We had a 90% customer satisfaction, and more importantly, we were also committed to the largest ever train improvement programme, over £475 million. We've got 180 brand new carriages being introduced from 2017, and over two-thirds of our existing carriages will be refurbished by 2018. But we're very proud of the fact that we played a part in launching the UK's longest new domestic railways, which is the Borders Railway. And this is a presentation that our Managing Director, Phil Verster, gives in many areas and emphasises the importance of the Borders Railway. You'll be very familiar with the history, so I don't intend to go through that. But it's very clear when the Borders Railway was started that ScotRail had to take a different approach, and that's what we believe we have done in the Borders Railway. We had to make sure that the Borders was, as reported here, became very much the new destination, not only the new Scottish destination, but the new destination within the United Kingdom. But more importantly, what was the role of ScotRail in making sure that the local authorities and the communities and the areas and the businesses within the Borders benefited to the projected incomes and support, and the target of that is over £33 million. At the end of this year, we are currently waiting on the final figures, but it's projected that passenger numbers will be well over 1 million passengers, and that's above where we had projected, and I think that's a reflection of a very positive step forward in creating the new railway. But what I want to emphasise is our commitment and some of the details around that in the last year. Borders Railway and the successful operation of that railway is seen as an executive priority. Abellio UK's board and the ScotRail Alliance board have specific and regular updates on the Borders Railway performance. We are a key member, as your Chief Executive mentioned. We've been active since before the railway was actually opened in being a part of the Borders Blueprint programme. That wasn't just to ensure that performance and the railway itself was operated, but that as ScotRail we were doing as much as we could to make sure that the added value was being met, and I'll touch on some of the things that we're already doing. We have created a dedicated resource for the Borders Railway, and that's my colleague Lindley Kirkpatrick. We have no other resource like this operating within Scotland at the moment, so it is a dedicated individual that is funded by ScotRail and the local partners in the Scottish Government to make sure that the Borders Railway is as successful as we can make it. And I'm sure that Lindley, when he comes to his work every single day, is very much focused on making sure that everything that ScotRail can be done is being done. And what that gives is an immediate ability for members of the council, for the chief executive and other officers of the council, to very quickly make contact with ScotRail and our colleagues to deal with any matters that are pertinent. And I think it's a very positive step and something that we are very keen to continue. It has also been an early focus for a new role within the company around our ScotRail tourism manager. The first significant activities that our tourism manager was involved in was ensuring that the successful launch of the Borders Railway took place. So in terms of our first year, passenger volumes have been higher than forecast. There has, however, been a variation, as you'll be aware, on a station-by-station basis. And there will be a number of reasons around each of those, and it's ScotRail's responsibility to work with our partners to ensure that at that station-by-station basis, at that local authority basis, that we ensure that where positive numbers are being seen, that we continue to support and grow those, and where there is the potential to grow passenger numbers at individual stations, we work to ensure that action is put in place to address these shortfalls. We've already seen some early economic and community impacts. Significant improvements in demand for housing applications for sales of housings within the bordered railway route are higher than the similar areas within Scotland. We've also seen some individual capacities where in say, areas such as Gore Bridge, the new nursery has opened on the back of the new railway in place, and the demand for commuters to be able to drop their children off at a local nursery and then commute into the city for employment. And I think this is just the start of it, and we'll continue to work there. We have, however, as the Chief Executive has indicated, we have recognised that there are performance challenges, and ultimately that's what's to be expected when it's the first new railway of its kind to be opened. And we're very clear that these are performance challenges that we as a company take very seriously. And I'd like to take just a brief opportunity to talk through some of those. Hopefully you'll see from the diagram on the screen there. This is the Borders Route PPM, which is effectively our passenger performance measurement. What this requires is, based on our trains, to arrive on schedule within 4 minutes and 59 seconds of its timetabled arrival. Currently, in layman, simple terms, we are tasked with ensuring that just over 9.2 of every train arrives within PPM, and we are currently sitting at 8.5. We are absolutely confident that the actions we're going to put in place will see that gap close, but I think we have to be absolutely clear that it is an 8.5 out of every 10 trains is arriving within the PPM that we are scheduled to do, but we are committed to ensure that that's met. What you'll see there are the examples of where we have had severe weather, we have had examples of issues with counter axles, and I'll talk about those. We had operating staffing issues, which, as people will be familiar with, was during the period of the industrial action. What I would say to members is that during that time, we were committed to continuing to operate the Borders Railway, and there was a number of other routes that we were not able to fully ensure that the capacity and trains were operated in, but we made a very conscious decision to ensure that the Borders Railway was operated during these times of industrial dispute. And latterly, the point regarding our radiator issues. So I want to talk more importantly so that as members you understand what we're doing in terms of our performance improvement plans, and Andy will be happy to answer any of the questions on those. The first point there was an issue around axle counters. There had been recordings of where the axle counters, and these effectively are on the tracks, and as the train passes over, it triggers signals. And that determines whether a train is in a single section or is not. What we have done as a result of the axle count affairs is we've undertaken a detailed review of those. We've introduced effectively a much shorter maintenance period. The recommended period of manufacturers is 9 months. We are now going to be doing a 3-month review of all of the counters on the Borders Railway. But more importantly, what we identified was in fact that within the route there was a number of small, very short power surges within the railway linked to the main power supply. And as a result of that, what we are intending to do is actually introduce an uninterrupted power supply. So it's a very short number of seconds which would make the counter axle fail. It wasn't the counter axle itself, it's the main supply that was coming in. We have identified this, and in December we're now trialling the introduction of the new UPS. We anticipate that this will be successful, and if introduced, this will see an additional investment, which we've already ring-fenced, of over £600,000 early next year to see the new UPS introduced, which should see a dramatic reduction in the number of failures within that section of it. We also have introduced around our Class 158 fleet the improved radiator design. People will be familiar with the topography of the Borders route, which placed a challenge on some of the stock. And as a result of that, we're currently trialling 2 units. And if successful, we'll see the rollout of the additional radiator design by summer 2017 for all of the Borders line. Our trains are also now being met with engineers at Waverley Station on a regular basis. In terms of performance issues, this is regarding the overall control and development. There are a number of tasks that we're introducing there, which includes a minor timetabling tweak to ensure that the on-trains have now the appropriate time between arriving at Waverley and departing for Tweed Bank. So that dwell time has been extended. Revenue is a matter which we are conscious of, and ensuring that we have a proactive campaign. Introducing a new railway line is in fact introducing details for our customers to understand how to access the railway. So we've got a proactive marketing campaign to support our smart card rollout and also the buy before you board. We are promoting the station ticket machines on all routes, and we've been introducing a number of dedicated switch teams within the borders where people are coming down and actually talking to passengers and explaining to them the ease of purchasing tickets in advance. And this is similar to the wider ScotRail route. And also at Waverley, we're introducing additional automatic gate machines to ensure that we are maximising the revenue that's been generated. In closing, just touch on our future investments. We are undertaking further passenger research to ensure that where passenger performance at individual stations varies from the projections, what are the reasons for that? Within the Midlothian, we have got to a position with the Newton Grange station building that hopefully from the 1st of April next year we'll be in a position to see an investment there of circa £750,000 to see that building brought back into use. And this is one of the very, very first examples of the new ScotRail franchise working with local partners to identify opportunities within the community. We're also looking to do something similar at Gore Bridge, where Lindley and colleagues are working with the community to look at a wider community potential and facility. And there's also a number of existing community activities around the Borders Rail Community Rail Partnership. We will continue to engage in the Blueprint programme, and that is not just in terms of staff resources, but it's financial resources to maximise the railway's potential. And we work very closely with the inward investment team for the Borders Line to make sure that we support the inward investment opportunities. I thank you very much for your time, and we'd be delighted to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Leisurewood. Councillor Young.
Thank you, Provost, and thank you for the presentation. My ward has S Bank station in it, and as much as I appreciate that, you know, making travel destinations and supporting inward investment is a key aim for the route. My main concern and the sort of feedback that I get most often is probably people getting to and from work primarily from the area around S Bank station, and then also using it as a leisure route. And so I suppose I just have two areas of questions that touch on what you've already said, but maybe just a little bit more request for a little bit more detail. The first is just the provision of carriages in terms of overcrowding at peak times, people being unable to get a seat and that sort of thing. And I know that there are plans afoot to improve that, but I just wanted to hear a little bit more and see if we could maybe get a little bit more detail. And then the second issue is just reliability. And obviously, if people are going to be using the route as a means to get to work, they need to be able to trust that they'll get to their work on time, which has, you know, obviously a big benefit for the people using it. But also, if you've ever tried to use the city bypass, getting on around about here, you'll appreciate that anything we can do to encourage people onto the railway is welcome. And I noticed that in terms of the performance measurements, I read a report that said there was only 7 weeks out of 52 where the Borders Railway met the target of being substantively on time. So I just wondered what could be done to improve that reliability so that people can kind of trust the railway to get them to work and keep them off the roads and out of their cars. Thanks very much.
Thank you for your question, Councillor. Within the line, say, we are taking the both reliability and punctuality of the border service extremely seriously. Within Edinburgh Waverley, we have a performance control room set up. We review the performance of the Borders and Border Service alone on a weekly basis. That includes staff from across the lines, including train crew staff, including signallers, to get first-hand information from frontline staff on what they're experiencing on the service. There's no doubt that is a very challenging service to operate, but when you look at the key issues that have caused performance to drop across the year, we're certainly addressing them. The axle counter issue, we're confident that when the axle counter UPS is fitted on the 16th, we will not see the same level of disruption due to axle counter failures. We will have that in as a trial for a period of 4 weeks and then roll it out to the other six locations. Just to be clear, what we found is that the Scottish power supply was dropping out for anything between half a second and 4 seconds. It's not enough to get information from Scottish Power to say that it was a power cut per se, but it was causing the microprocessor within the UPS to drop out. And as far as we got what we call a red spread, so we got a number of signals in the area go to red, and we know from speaking to passengers that train's been a few minutes late is not great, but when your train is cancelled, that's a whole different ball game. Those are the areas that we really need to protect, and those are the areas that we're focusing on. Things like the Class 158 radiator issue that we have. Now, we've experienced it here and we've experienced it in the far north because they're different services from the Fife Circle, for example, because of the topography of the rail network. We have units on trial at the moment. We've got specialist radiator contractors in who are testing the units to make sure that those radiators will provide the necessary capacity for this network. We will then be rolling it out to all 158s. Now, even if we don't have the supply chain to get it on all the units, we will protect the border services to make sure that the border services have units with those improved radiators fitted. So there are a number of elements round about there. James spoke about we'll have one particular service in the morning which I know causes a great deal of issues. It's the 8:24, comes off of Stirling, sits for 2 minutes and then goes on to the border service. Now, it doesn't take much for that late running off of Stirling to impact on the borders. So from the December timetable change, that increases to 7 minutes. So we're taking, as we see these issues, we're taking a number of actions to improve the overall reliability of the service, and we realise how important it is. It's 100 years you've waited for a train. We don't want you to wait for another 30 minutes by cancelling one.
Councillor Young, do you want to come back on that?
Thank you, Provost. Just to thank you for the answer, and also just if I could ask you to touch on the extra capacity, the carriages issue as well.
Thanks. This is a matter we're looking at across the board, Councillor. In every significant line at peak time, obviously there are challenges, and that's the real challenge for the rail industry, is at peak time when there's greater demand. We're looking at across the board. We're also looking at some of the stock that was going to be taken out of service at the end of its lifetime when the introduction of the new trains would be there, and some of that stock will now be retained and introduced. So we anticipate that over the next few months we'll see a greater level of detail of that coming out for you.
Councillor Muirhead.
Thanks, Provost. I remember being quite frustrated when you were approaching the kind of opening of the railway, and you read criticisms on the internet, social media and things like that, for what I kind of thought were like the train spotters who were saying that the carriages that we were going to be getting on this line were inferior and things like that. And I can remember being quite frustrated, thinking, oh, we've waited this long, we've been involved in this for so long. Shut up. You know, it's ridiculous to be criticising it. You should be glad it's coming. But the reality is that in some ways they've kind of been proven right a wee bit. I'm intrigued as to why you would describe it as a challenging service to operate. What makes it different for any other service in particular? And can I also ask that the axle counter issues, the radiator issues, are these issues that are affecting train systems up and down the country, or is it peculiar to the vehicles that are being run on that line?
Okay, just to come back on the axle counter issue, we would not normally expect to see the number of power outages that were seen in this area, so it would normally affect it to that extent. So I would suggest it is rather peculiar to the borders area. The radiators, the topography is slightly different. We've seen a decline in the capacity of the radiators in the 158s over the last couple of years. So we suspect that's part of the reason behind it. But this new radiator will certainly address that issue.
Councillor Baxter.
Thank you, Provost. I'd like to ask a question about the ticket machines. Now, I know there have been problems. I've used the Borders line from S Bank to Tweed Bank a couple of times in the last few weeks, and on both occasions the ticket machine wasn't working several weeks between the two events. I believe it is now working, but it is an issue. When the Borders line was first opened, the stations in the Borders line were not even on the machines. But I have a particular question about a current issue which somebody's contacted me about, and I believe they've contacted you on several occasions, Lindley, and they've not received a reply. And that's a scheme at the moment where kids go free, which I believe involves buying a parent's ticket on the railway and getting the children's tickets free. Now, that works fine if you go to the station or buy it from staff, but the ticket machines are still charging for the children in that particular case. Now, the person who contacted me, they asked the conductor on the train, you know, why isn't this working? They didn't know the answer to that, but they said that you can claim a refund, and they've tried to claim a refund. But it's a roundabout process. They have to go into Waverley Station and claim the money back. Now, why on earth isn't the software for the ticket machines upgraded before any such schemes are introduced? Because they're advertised to encourage people to use the trains, and then they go and then they find that they don't get the discount that's been advertised.
Thanks, Councillor Baxter, for your comments here. I'm assuming you mean the ticket machines in the stations and on the platforms, yeah. So the TVM machines, yeah. The TVM machines are regularly and constantly being updated as part of the process, and our revenue team are looking at that process. We are introducing, as part of, as I touched upon there, the wider marketing and media, the appropriate software upgrades to ensure that they're met, and that includes additional matters such as being able to purchase the tickets from the machine in advance, which was something that we were beginning to see. So the ticket machines are and will be regularly promoted. I will specifically, if I can, pick up on the matter with the Kids Go Free out with this meeting, because it's something we take very seriously if a member of the public has contacted us and we've not responded to them. So if I could, either through yourself or directly, we will pick up with that, because these are very important schemes for us. You know, we want people to be travelling on the trains. We particularly want people to be travelling on the trains out with peak times and taking advantage of the trains appropriately. And things like our Kids Go Free and Club 50 and all that are very, very important to us. And I certainly will make sure that your representative gets a response on that.
Councillor Pottinger.
Again, thank you for the presentation, and I found some of the technical aspects very, very interesting on the signal, etc. And your presentation, when you're mentioning the statistics about timetable failure, the statistic I have is 25% timetable failure in the first year of operation. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that seemed to be the banner headline, and that's what I'm working on. And you'd probably agree with me that 25% failure rate is, you know, maybe needing to be explained a bit more about the parameters for that failure rate. But And also you'd probably want to say that it's unacceptable, but what kind of failure rate would be acceptable, and how does that compare with the average failure rates of a timetable? Obviously, we're all very concerned what can be done and what can be done in the short term, and and if there's no carriages there available to realign to the network, then overcrowding issue will continue till the new carriages arrive, and that has caused many of my constituents in Newton Grange a bit of concern. If they can't rely on getting onto the train, and they can't rely on getting a seat onto the train, and the operations, the likelihood of them reducing their desire to actually be a customer. You touched a wee bit on the role of the guard, and I'm presuming all those issues are now totally resolved. And was the industrial action part of the failure rate calculations, or was that separate? Yes, they can be dismayed when there's trains are on industrial action and there's no trains running, but they're still selling the tickets at the station. You know, I think more could be done on that, and a lot of references to the website, etc. But still something maybe could be done on IT, that the ticket machine could actually display there's no trains running from the station at that time. The future proofing, we're all very much concerned about the Tweed Bank line, and what kind of measures have been done, because the demand and the number of carriages could increase, but what about the frequency of the actual train operations? Is there any possibility of frequency of service increasing, particularly at peak periods? And I'll just finish on a wee bugbear of mine at Newton Grange station. You've still got that sign at the platform saying you are here and you aren't. You know, it refers to the old Station Road site in Newton Grange, where the train station was in the 1960s. Eh? So if you could just please, because I've said to so many council officers on that, get that trackside sign made correct. Thanks.
Thank you for your comments and questions, Councillor. The 25% failure rate, I'm assuming, comes from the Borders Rail monitor. As part of our franchise, we're obligated to monitor our services in terms of PPM, which is the public performance monitor. So for a train to pass PPM, it has to arrive at destination within 4 minutes 59 seconds. It has to have run from the start of the journey to the end, and it has to have stopped at all booked stations. So if we run a train that doesn't go between Edinburgh and Tweed Bank, if it turns halfway, it would be a PPM failure. If it didn't stop at all the stations it's booked to stop, it would be a PPM failure. And if it arrived within 4 minutes 59, after 4 minutes 59 seconds, it would be a PPM failure. Currently, our MEA, our annual PPM for Tweed Bank for the Borders line is 84.7. As a national statistic, we're currently running at 89.7. So we're some 5% off the national average, and it is our intention to close that gap. And that's what our performance plan, both in terms of our immediate actions and our longer-term actions, are designed to address. You asked a question about the role of the guard. Obviously, they have a valuable part to play in this. And you asked if those cancellations were included within our statistics, and that is the case. So, particularly during that time, we had a number of short notice cancellations because of unavailability of train crew, and those would be counted as a PPM failure.
Councillor, I'll just pick up again, maybe separately at some point up through Lindley, just to pick up on your point about the trackside sign in Newton Grange. It's not something that's been brought to our attention or my attention, but I'll certainly make sure that it is after this meeting.
Councillor Emery.
Thanks very much, Provost. Can I maybe take you back prior to a year ago? And that is that you, as one of the bidders, bid for the ScotRail franchise. And I'm just trying to get in my head here an understanding of a comment that was made, I think, during your presentation, that you were surprised at passenger growth. I have to say that Edinburgh and the southeast of Scotland have enjoyed unprecedented growth for nigh on 10 years. The figures that come out year on year on year show that rail patronage is nothing like any other part of Scotland. And therefore, I was rather surprised that when you knew they had to open the Borders rail line, or the Waverley line, as it should really be called, when you knew that that was coming on board, and it was in the last franchise as well, although it wasn't built, so therefore it didn't kick in, I find it really, really depressing that you are surprised that people actually used the rail line. The BCR that we all worked to, and the Scottish Government were told this as well, or Transport Scotland were, should I say, they were told quite clearly and quite openly that the amount of patronage would be a lot higher than what was anticipated in the first place. And that has been shown throughout the length and breadth of Scotland, where you've had a new station introduced along an existing line. And therefore, what I'm trying to really get from you is, given that you had knowledge, and I'm sure you saw the books, because it's an open book contest as far as franchise bidding is concerned, how did you not know that, first of all, rolling stock wasn't there, or in the numbers that was needed and required, not just for the Waverley line, but for the interconnects as well, because people just don't just travel from Tweed Bank along the Waverley line and stop at Edinburgh Waverley. They sometimes then go on to other lines, whether it be north, west, or indeed, dare I say, east. So I'm a little bit surprised that there doesn't seem to be a knowledge of that. Now, was it that there was a cap put on what the bid could be and what the public purse was prepared to pay, and therefore you had to work within the cost envelope of that? Or was it that we in this country of ours, we don't seem to be able to anticipate growth and wait until the growth's happened and then decide we better do something about it? In other words, we're being reactive instead of proactive. And I'm trying to find out from you is where you sit within that kind of envelope that I'm trying to describe. In other words, you knew what you were coming into, what was anticipated of being done as soon as, and we're talking 2017, 2018 before new rolling stock comes in, which might not actually hit the right parts of the network, because we might get the second-hand stuff coming to the Waverley line, but that's another story. But I'm still trying to get my head round. There was all of a sudden a problem with the Class 158s, when in actual fact, Class 158s have run all over Scotland for many, many years. So really, I'll leave it on that. I could say a lot more, but I'll leave it on that. Thanks, Provost.
Councillor, many thanks for your comments. If the words were used about we were surprised, then that's maybe in the wrong context. I certainly didn't intend if that was what was said. What I think, Councillor, in terms of passenger numbers, the answer to your point, the passenger numbers and the route and the franchise components that we, along with all the other bid in for, are very detailed in terms of the provision of the number of routes that you must operate, the timetable that you must operate to, the provision of services and trains and units with on that. So you're absolutely right. All of the bidders get to see that, and you're correct in the sense that that's very much set by Transport Scotland on the route. I think what we would, if we use again reference about surprise, what has been surprising, I guess, and the figures mark that up, is the significant variations within the individual stations and passenger numbers. And I think that has to be recognised by us all. So, for example, Tweed Bank, it clearly is a surprise that the passenger predictions are 10 times what was expected there. I think 10 times would be reasonable enough to suggest that that's surprisingly high. So it's 10 times the number of passengers have went through Tweed Bank. At both Gala Shields and Stow, the numbers are 5 times what were within the business case. And I'll not go through them all, but examples. So Shaw Fair is currently running about a fifth of what were in it. So my apologies if I've suggested that they're surprised at numbers. I don't think anyone was surprised at the numbers. I think what we are having to take account of is the variations in those and the implications that has for going forward. And I think the point I was just trying to make was that where passenger numbers are maybe not where they are at the moment, they may very well come on in time. So, for example, at Shaw Weir, Fair Housing Development may take a bit of time. How do we make sure, as that housing development comes on board, that we are ready to take account of the increase in passenger numbers there? So it's very much, and again, things like S Bank, how do we continue to work with the colleges and so forth to make sure that the appeal is there? So, no, we were not surprised in terms of, I think, and my apologies if that's come over, but what we are clear about is that there has been variations in the passenger numbers that we really want to make sure that where we can improve passenger numbers in particular localities, we do everything we can to work with local stakeholders to make that happen. Thank you.
Councillor Beattie.
Thank you, Provost. Some of the questions I had have already been answered, but picking up on that last point, for which I thank you for the presentation and your very full answers, on that last point, you talked about making sure passengers were comfortable, provided for. This has been the general thrust, I think, of what you've been saying. And I represent the residents of an area that includes the S Bank station. And accordingly, I have a lot of comments from local residents who have used the station facilities, a lot of them around issues of ticket machines, often just not functioning. And particularly the one that's already been raised by one of my colleagues about the Child Goes Free matter. And I've had a number of residents constituents complaining to me about just that. I think we're culturally disposed to make observations, or rather comments, about our more negative observations rather than the positive. But I have to give you some reassuring news that, in fact, I've heard as many compliments about the service provision as I have negative comments. A lot of people are thoroughly delighted to have it. But the single biggest criticism is about overcrowding and the fact that when families have taken parents have taken their children on board, or sometimes an elderly relative on a journey with them, they have had such a negative experience that they would hesitate to use the service ever again due to what they experienced as severe overcrowding on the train. And I appreciate the comments you've already made about how that would be addressed in the future, but I'd appreciate your advice about how we might respond, or how I might respond, to constituents who make those observations about the situation right now, rather than jam tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Beattie, for your comments. Yeah, I think my message would be the same. We are actively attempting to target those areas within all of our services where overcrowding is identified. We're working very closely with our customer experience team and our train plan team to make sure that where we can, we can make that journey as comfortable for everyone as possible. I think it's very much about, we know, I think everyone knows, when the peak times are and the challenges are in the railway around, you know, early mornings and afternoons, and that's when the challenge would be. That's the nature of the rail industry at the moment. Quite often you can then find for 4 or 5 hours during the day that there's lots of space on the trains and the journey is very comfortable. What I can reassure you, Councillor, is that we hope that it's not just about jam tomorrow in the long term, but in a much shorter period of time that we can begin to see some real differences there. I think you're right. We are we are absolutely confident that the borders as a railway is very much about promoting the benefits rather than where some of the challenges may lie. And hopefully in the very near future we'll begin to see some of the improvements coming in, particularly around minimising overcrowding where possible.
Thank you, Provost. If I could just come back on that point about the ticket machines and the fact that sometimes they have in many cases not functioned at all for some reason, or in others the issue that you've already answered.
No, Councillor, I'm going to, what I can assure you, and I think it's been raised previously as well, I will make a point of now discussing with our Head of Revenue the issue around the ticket machines. We were very conscious when we introduced the railway that ticketing was going to be something that we'd have to spend a lot of time around. We've now got the first year's lessons behind us. We are looking to improve access to the ticket machines. We are looking to improve access on train. The new handheld ticket machines that are being operated obviously offer much greater flexibility. The other thing I'm very much about is that in the future, as we get to smart technology, that's where people who, for example, are looking to regularly use Children Go Free can begin to look at using some of that smart technology. And I think that's what, as a whole industry and as a whole network, we're trying to do. So I will certainly take back those particular issues and make sure that Mr. Laurie gets a response on those directly. Thank you.
Councillor Devink.
I would like to follow up on Councillor Muirhead's point when you use the word challenging. The railway line has cost £10 million per mile, 35 miles, £350 million. For you to now suggest that this has created challenges makes me believe that it is the management that has been inadequate. You are saying you have got at Tweed Bank 10 times the number of people you expected, but in Shawfare only a quarter. Now, you must be doing awfully well with the 10 times when you have a ticket that is worth a great deal more than from Shawfare to Edinburgh. I feel it's very depressing that Abellio, which was a company that used to have a fantastic good record, but even now in the Netherlands, their record seems to be very poor indeed. I'm really disappointed that you are not doing much more to get your house in order. I'm very disappointed.
Thank you, Councillor. I think it's just we need to be clear. It's a point of just clarity. The passenger figures prepared for the Borders railway route were prepared by Transport Scotland. The projections on that are not prepared by any of the potential bidders and are not prepared by Abellio ScotRail or the ScotRail Alliance. So I think that was a point the Councillor had raised earlier. We are operating to figures that were prepared in a business case that we were being asked to deliver. We are now reporting on the passenger numbers at each of those and now working with Transport Scotland to ensure that we understand what the implications of the current passenger numbers are and how we take them in the future forward.
Sorry, if I may, you bid for a contract. Surely you would have done your due diligence on whatever figures were produced. If you are bidding for a very substantial contract and somehow the figures that were offered to you were suspect, you would have had to surely do your due diligence on that. I can't believe you wouldn't have done that.
Thank you, Councillor. You're absolutely correct. What we have said is that the projected figures for the Borders Railway will be exceeded. But that's just the top line projections. And ultimately, the figures that you as members of Midlothian Council are receiving are the figures based on Transport Scotland's projections, and that's what will become the public figures, and that's what you will be provided. So in reality, that set of guidelines, that baseline, is presented effectively by the government, and we're reporting on performance, on actual performance. ultimately now as we go forward, the business plan and the services will be adapted to take account of those.
Councillor Milligan.
Thank you, Provost. I think it's been said before, this railway was a long time coming and was very expensive, and included in that expense, a lot of house builders and then the house buyers were expected to contribute towards this line coming on as a critical part of the house building programme for this area. And keep in mind that this has been identified as a hotspot yet again for further development. I've got to say, you say right at the start that punctuality and reliability were the sort of key factors in making this service work. And the reality is anybody going to work that needed to be at work in time, that had connections to get to other places and that, quite simply, quite quickly, walked away from the stations in Midlothian saying, we can't risk this any longer. We need to find a more reliable way to get to where we're going. We're stuck in the middle because you have Gala, all the Borders railways to start with, and then you have Edinburgh coming out, and we're sort of stuck in the middle. So if your trains are full and jam-packed and can't take folk, it's your constituents that can't get on. And if your trains are cancelled, then obviously nobody can go on. And you can't have that if you're trying to run a successful business, if you're working for any company at all. So therefore, reliability and punctuality are the key words here. And I've got to say, the constituents that speak to me haven't seen that coming through. The reality that I have still concerns about is we are now still identified as a hotspot for future development. I'm not sure that the planned growth that you're looking at could actually meet the demand now. If you get your reliability problem sorted, I think the demand will simply go through the roof in the area if you can carry the passengers. We're now looking at massive growth coming to this area and being asked to take this massive growth. How can we be sure the figures that have been put forward to us, the passenger numbers that are likely to be expected, and for what we're getting back for our constituents saying we would quite happily get on this train if it was more reliable and more punctual, we would certainly get on this train. How can we be sure that the growth that you've tied in now is going to meet even demand as it is at the moment, nevertheless the house building that we're expected to take in the near future?
Thank you, Councillor. What I would say is that, first of all, as we've mentioned, I think, a couple of times now, a PPM performance is just 5% below our national performance. So it is still 8.5 trains arriving on time. So the question of punctuality, I appreciate, at an individual level, may have an impact. Whether that is the root cause of some of the lower figures within the Midlothian areas, I would think we'd need to do more work and more research to find out what some of those reasons are. I accept that there will be anecdotal evidence at an individual basis, and that was why one of the points that we had made on the presentation was to find out a bit more about passenger information and passenger surveys about if there is a latent demand there that's not been met, then can we find out what that would be? But some of the figures for performance in the Midlothian station didn't drop off. It wasn't people started and then fell away. The figures have remained very, very consistent, and we need to understand that. We're absolutely committed to working with the council around the house building programme. That's why somewhere like Shaw Fair is very important, because the future demand and growth of Shaw Fair will, as you say, have impacts on the railway, and we need to be in a position to respond to that. And that's the commitment that we're giving, is to work very closely with the council and other partners to make sure that we do provide a service that the council can be proud of and pleased with, and so can we.
Councillor Kelly.
Or Councillor Parry. Thank you very much for your presentation. I just wanted to conclude, perhaps, the conversation by making a plea on behalf of all of Midlothian residents, because I am councillor for Midlothian West, which doesn't sit on the Borders Railway, and there's a number of our wards that don't. But as Councillor Milligan alluded to, Midlothian residents contribute in one way or another, financially, emotionally. They've waited for the railway for a long time. And so one of the things that I would like to see that isn't about rolling stocks and your PPMs and your carriages and all the other jargon that clearly people are better informed about than me, but it's just around customer demand from other parts of Midlothian and about how you can make that possible. At the moment, there's little alignment between bus services and aligning them with the services stations that are served by the Borders Railway. So I really just wanted to find out if that's something that you have been doing as a piece of work. Is it something that you can do better? Because I think even when we have got, for example, families on a Saturday afternoon, maybe living in Pennycook or in my own ward, when they know that it's not a peak time and they know that it's not going to be particularly busy, we want to change the way that Midlothian people do things, because we want to make sure that we're not driving people or pushing them into driving into cars and such, like making Midlothian a greener place. So just to find out a wee bit more detail about that, and if you're not doing that, could you please do that? Thank you.
Thanks, Councillor. The simple answer is yes, we are, and we're committed to doing that in partnership with all of the stakeholders. Integrated transport is really what you're talking about, and we are committed to doing that. We have significant investment in car parking provision at a number of the stations within Midlothian and the wider Borders line, and that's something we're actively reviewing to make sure that where we can, we positively promote that, and we positively promote that to allow people to travel in the most efficient and most sustainable way that they can. We're also working closely as part of an integration team to look at how we make better connections between rail and bus, but how we also make better connections with cycle routes and provision of cycle parking at our stations, our Bike and Go programme, how we make sure that when we work with new housing development, that the housing development doesn't be constructed 500 metres from the station, but then find that you physically can't walk to that station in a safe and well-lit and active way. So, yeah, I think I can reassure you, Councillor, that we are very, very committed to making sure, not only in the Borders line, but across the country, that we have a huge issue about congestion, about car travel and about sustainability, and public transport has to be the solution to that. So that's very much part of the agenda and what we're pushing, and certainly is high on the agenda on the Borders line.
Councillor Russell.
Thank you, Provost. Coming to that issue with regards to the Exbach station and obviously the links for transport, I'm fortunate enough to have a local service in our area, which is the 39, and it goes stops at Tesco, and you can come through. I don't drive, I'm a lone female, so the actual walk through from Tesco's to the station is quite dark. It's all built up, fences, etc., so it can be quite intimidating. Obviously not so much during the day, but if you've been out using the quite good rail service, I have to say, at the times that I travel. That's quite a major worry for myself and obviously for other lone females that don't drive. So I would like you to look at if it's possible to have better lighting. Obviously, I can't speak for other stations. I can only speak for the one that I use in that particular. I think it's the only one that looks like that. The rest are all quite open. But it's just the fact that if you haven't used the public transport element, you have to go through that walkway.
Thank you, Councillor. Yeah, we'll take on that specific point for you. What again, I would reassure you is that one of the things about the stations and the Borders line is that they have good quality access for all ability at our stations. We've also got CCTV coverage in all of the stations, which is monitored centrally. But I will certainly pick up on that particular one and get Lindley to look into that for you.
Right, colleagues, I think we've had a full and frank discussion on ScotRail, and we've had full and frank answers, and I'm sure ScotRail will take them away and come back with answers for us. Thank you, Mr. Ledgerwood, and your team for your presentation today. Thank you. Item 8.2 is a presentation to elected members by Grant Thornton and from Paul Dossett. Thank you.
Thank you, Provost. Reflecting on that last conversation, I'm probably glad that I went into the auditing profession when I was 21 rather than into the provision of railways. Anyway, moving on to the audit. Hopefully you've got a copy of the report which we took to Audit Committee on 21st of September, and it's our annual sort of audit report. And first of all, Grant Thornton has been your auditors for 5 years, and that term has now come to an end, and there's new auditors, Ernst & Young, who will be taking over. And I'd like to take the opportunity from Grant Thornton and all the staff who have worked on the audit over the years to thank officers and members for their support to the audit. You can't do an audit without support from officers and members, and we thank you for that. In terms of the 15-16 audit, I think it was a good year as far as the audit of the financial statements was concerned. We signed an unqualified opinion on the accounts on 20th September, and I think that was probably the earliest we'd managed, and we were well in time in terms of deadline is 30th September, and we were comfortably in time, were able to sign the accounts straight after the audit committee. And the audit went very smoothly. We identified some control issues related to asset valuations, to some of the results of our journal testing and employee debt, and that's covered in detail in the report. In terms of the wider scope of our audit, there were a number of items we've identified. For example, integrated joint board, of the progress that you've made on that, and I think again comparing to Scotland as a whole, I think you've made good progress on that, and I think we're very pleased with the progress, and it looks like it's one of your absolute strengths. I think the other thing I would draw out is the modernisation of your pay scheme and the new arrangements you brought in there, which I think are important in terms of, you know, workforce modernisation in the light of future challenges. And I think in terms of those challenges, I mean, clearly local government throughout the UK has significant challenges. I mean, some of those are based on the broader macroeconomic situation. Some of those are based on government policy. And clearly, Scottish Government are taking a sort of quite hard line on finances over the next few years, and you along with other local authorities of Scotland have some significant challenges to meet. And I think in that context, it's worth reflecting that your reserves are in a relatively good position compared to other authorities of Scotland. I think in terms of reserves as a percentage of income, I think you're the sort of second best placed of local authorities in Scotland, but of course none of that doesn't mean you haven't got challenges, and there's some significant challenges. And I think the council's whilst the council has been able to deliver savings in some areas, I think holistically has not had the best track record in delivering savings. And I think if you think of the challenges going forward, that's going to be an area I think of real focus for you, and I know that officers and members are very aware of that challenge. And clearly also you have, as was featured in the previous discussion, I mean, clearly there's a big growth agenda, and there's a great, I think, opportunity of the council to be at the forefront of that, and I think that's a really important area. So I think from our point of view, they're the main issues coming from our audit, and I'd be happy to take any questions that members have.
Thank you, Mr. Dossett. Any questions from members? Okay, then. You get the escape quite lightly then here. Mr. Laurie.
Sure. Just to say, as Paul said, this presentation marks the end of Grant Thornton's 5-year appointment as the external auditors for the council. So I think it'd be appropriate for the council to recognise that and thank Paul and his colleagues for their good work over that 5-year period, if I could suggest that, Provost.
Thank you. Did you wish to say something, Councillor Dwight?
the chief executive took words out of my mouth. I really feel that Grant Thornton has done an exemplary job. I know a little bit about auditing, and I've seen many auditors, and they stood out, and I'm really, in a way, disappointed that their term of office has come to an end. One of the things I hope to discuss with the Auditor General, that we should, as a council, have more of a say in who should succeed you. This is all being done by herself, and I would like to challenge that.
Okay, thanks once again, Mr. Dussett, and you're welcome to stay and listen to the rest of the council meeting, if you so wish. Item 8.3, a review of the United Kingdom Parliamentary... I do, yes. I'm trying to catch up back on the line so we get back on time with our train. But you're correct. We now move on to our motions. Chinese lanterns, a motion by Councillor Dvink.
Well, I'll make it very brief. I take it that everyone has read the motion. It's very straightforward. These sky lantern or Chinese lanterns, they appear to be very harmless. They're very emotional. They're things that people put up in the air without really thinking about it. But the consequences are quite severe. And the National Farmers Union of Scotland is quite right to point out that it brings an enormous number of dangerous aspects with it. And that we, like the other eight local councils have already banned this practice. We in Midlothian should do the same. Now, the National Union of Farmers in Scotland did not ask us to get involved with the issue of the fireworks, and I think this motion should stand on its own rather than confuse it with the fireworks, and I commend it.
Councillor Bryant.
Thank you, Provost. I'm happy to second this motion. I can well remember speaking to a small grandchild and explaining how these worked and how they flew off into the air and then fell down safely to earth. And obviously that's not what happens in all cases.
Councillor Montgomery, do you want to move an amendment to this motion?
Yeah, well, I didn't know what to move as a counter motion. I mean, I think there was an explanation earlier. I mean, it really was an addendum, which is really the last two lines. I mean, I don't know what Councillor Devine's thinking. I mean, if we're going to ban the Chinese lanterns for council ground, I think it's a no-brainer that we do it with fireworks as well. They're every bit as lethal and every bit as dangerous as the Chinese lanterns. Owen Thompson MP has taken some measures in Parliament for it, and I spoke to Councillor Parry earlier on, and hopefully there's going to be some feedback coming from there. With the Veterans Association on the other day complaining about the fireworks because they're getting flashbacks. When this was raised a year past December, I had representations for the SSPCA. Many individuals and pet owners who were really worried about the whole thing. And I just think in terms of public safety, it's a no-brainer. If we're banning the Chinese lanterns, we should be including the fireworks as well. And I really can't see why you're not prepared to accept that, because that would then still be your motion, which I think would make a bit of sense. If you're not prepared to do that, I'll put it to the vote. And if you vote against the fireworks, well, we'll take that as it comes. But I think you should just accept it. That still stays as your motion, and it would be seen as an addendum, really just the two lines added on.
Formally second, Provost.
Thank you. Councillor Parry, you can speak as well.
Oh, thanks, Provost. I just wanted to ask, and I guess it's maybe a question for officers, was just around the council land terminology, and I just wanted to make sure that is there an accepted definition of what that means? I actually don't have a problem with addendum at all whatsoever. I think it would be good to take it on board, but what I don't want to do is to make it a situation whereby a council tenant can't little fireworks, but a private tenant can. So I just want to make sure that that's clarified, or that it's at least taken on board in the language of the discussion today, and then I'd be happy to take that on board.
Chair, the simplest method to cover that point, maybe if both all four movers and seconders accept that by council land they're referring to non-domestic properties, and that would therefore cover the council tenants not having the same right as perhaps an owner-occupier living next door to them.
Are the movers and seconders happy to accept that definition of what is council property and what's not? Okay. Are we now happy to accept the motion as amended? Okay, thank you. Item 7.2, a motion by Councillor Russell.
Thank you, Provost. The motion kind of obviously speaks for itself in respect of the things that have been happening in the centre of Dalkeith, and I'm sure probably in other areas of Midlothian. And as the motion does address the issues facing local businesses in Dalkeith and obviously the local residents in the town centre, by this antisocial behaviour of local youth rampaging through the town, there's obviously a cost to the shops, such as Morrison's, who have now had to employ security. And there's all the broken windows to be replaced, some in council-owned properties. Obviously, as an elected member and the other two elected members, you look to see what you can do to mitigate NF issues. And we have had meetings with council officers and the Chief Inspector, Kenny Simpson, and along with some of the residents from Jarnac Court, because these are the ones who have been suffering the brunt of the behaviour. And some assurances were given. One hopes that issues will be put into place, but it appears that between 15 and 20 youth are gathering around the Jarnac area on many occasions, and police cars have been called out following the complaints, but nothing's been happening. There have been other areas in Woodburn, the area that I actually live in, where trouble has been sparked off among rival families. And I've contacted our funded officers to patrol the area to give a show of strength, but also to give assurances to the locals to make the streets a bit safer. And that, to me, has always been the beauty and the usefulness of the CAT teams, because they have a buy-in to our community, these officers, because they've been involved for quite a long time now. And if we lose that capacity to use the funding officers to work in our communities, then the decline of police numbers on the street, actually working on the street, and not stuck in the call centre at Bilson, more and more incidents will occur affecting our residents. So I move that this council agrees to withdraw the plans to remove funding from the CAT teams planned for April 2017 and to restore funding for the cuts already made. Thank you, Provost.
To be seconded by Councillor Muirhead.
Thanks, Provost. I think what we're witnessing in Dalkeith, and maybe to a slightly lesser extent in some other communities, is the first signs of the reductions in the CAT teams taking effect. It isn't just the reduction that we see as a decision of last year's budget, where we're cutting 25% of the CAT teams, but also the fact that between us taking the decision to scrap it all together and March 2017, there'll be adjustments being made to deploy the officers into other areas. I took the opportunity, quite timorously, we had the paperwork came in for the next police and fire board meeting. So I had a look at the stats for the CAT teams, and just to be absolutely 100% clear with the administration, who seem to believe that these statistics are, include activities with other officers. It is absolutely just the activities of the CAT teams. And I'll give you a few examples. The time spent on allocated patrol relevant to tasked antisocial behaviour hotspots in areas of concern in the quarter just passed in September, 1,009 hours. In the previous quarter, 2,173 hours. So significantly less than half the amount of hours spent on patrolling antisocial behaviour hotspots, which is a significant decrease and perhaps starts to explain some of the issues that we're having in our communities and in particular Dalkeith. Visits to party houses. In the previous quarter report, 9 visits to party houses over the quarter. And the report that we're going to have in front of us at the next Police and Fire Board, 2. From 9 down to 2. There are a whole host of other areas. Drug searches down from 50 to 37, from 19 to 10. Stolen property searches down from 16 to 9. And the important one here, when we're talking about the activities that are going on in Dalkeith, is the number of antisocial behaviour, youth antisocial behaviour calls, are down from 164 in the previous quarter to 123 in this quarter. Now, the problem that we have here, and I can understand, you know, given that all that we're paying that money for is additional resources that the police can deploy. If you think of the few people, the few police officers, now we've had it for the for good sources, the amount of police on occasion that are in Midlothian, across Midlothian, is very low. If the CAT teams are not there or the CAT teams are reduced, then your normal, for want of a better word, police are going to have to respond to antisocial behaviour issues. And the problem that that gives you is that when they do that, if they're going to take any action against the youths involved, they either have to take them maybe to see their parents, back to the house to talk to their parents, or take them to the police station. They're off the streets. And if there only happens to be 4 or 5 police officers on duty in that location, that's taking 2 officers out of the mix. The CAT teams are different. They can afford to do that kind of thing. So it's proactive and it's responding when they're doing their reactive calls. They're actually, they can take the time to process the misbehaving youth better. So what I think we're seeing here is the start of the issues, and I think they're only going to get worse as the CAT teams reduce over the period, and will get much worse come the end of March when the CAT teams are removed altogether. So I would urge, as I've urged you before, colleagues, to reconsider this decision. You know, it's no muckraking. It's no, you know, we're not just doing this to score points. I think personally, it's the worst decision I can remember the council taking, because it is really going to impact on our communities and it's causing great concern.
Councillor Parry.
Thanks, Provost. I think one of the things I was disappointed about there when proposing this motion is the lack of clarity around some of the points that's evidenced in the motion, and I had a particular few questions that I hoped would be covered, and disappointingly it was. But one of the most important things is, where would the spend related to the CAT teams come from, particularly given the significant budget pressures that face St Council both now and in the future? And secondly, where is the evidence that CAT teams, as opposed to operational police resources available now, cannot sufficiently meet this demand? And thirdly, and I think the most important answer that I would have liked to have seen from the proposer there was that, where is the evidence, Provost, that punitive, old-fashioned police measures rather than the holistic preventative approaches that we're currently undertaking, such as ensuring positive destinations for our young people, lifting communities out of poverty and working with colleagues, which is much more effective. And the evidence that I have says otherwise. Crime is at a 40-year low across Scotland, and we have more police officers in the street than we have for a long time. And lastly, just a point of advice, Provost, and just for the record, we've had many discussions about this at the Police and Fire Fire Board, and in fact it's in the minute, as Councillor Muirhead reminded me that the papers were out yesterday, is that I've made it absolutely clear that dialogue is open between me and my role as chair to all the elected members and all the board members and the police service, and to date I have had neither approach me and ask to have the CAT teams reinstated. So I know that Councillor Muirhead proclaims that this is not politics in the chamber, but I'm sorry, but without those points being answered and without coming forward with some meaningful conversation, I find that hard to believe. I would suggest that, like I do, that Labour Party group members work across the chamber, across the political divide, as I do, and if my colleagues are like-minded, I move that there's no action on this motion.
Councillor Muirhead.
Let me just try and answer some of the direct questions that have been put. As far as the budget is concerned, no, we didn't need to ask the proposer. I seconded it, and I'm going to answer that, if you don't mind. The budget issue, we would take, quite clearly, we would take that from reserves at this point, and in future years it would be incorporated into the revenue budget. Mm-hmm. And with respect, Councillor Parry, your role as chair of that board isn't a dictatorship. You didn't make the decisions. We didn't come to you to make the decisions as to whether the CAT team should be reinstated. We'll decide that as a council. Evidence. I think we're seeing the evidence of the results of withdrawing the CAT teams, and we're certainly seeing the evidence in terms of the proactive work. The police are coming forward here and they're telling us how much time they're able to spend with the CAT teams on these very important roles that they've got. And as for, you know, the punitive side of things, you clearly didn't allow. I live in Birkenside, and I tell you, if it wasn't for the CAT teams, I don't know where we would be. And I'd love you to come up at 2 o'clock in the morning to some of my neighbours to explain to them on the doorstep how positive destinations are going to help them when there's somebody causing havoc in the street outside them. We need the CAT teams to come up and deal with that kind of thing. So, you know, there's plenty of evidence if you actually open your eyes, go out there and speak to people in the streets in some of your communities that suffer the most for the antisocial behaviour that affects us.
Councillor Johnson.
I agree with Councillor Parry and propose no action. And the police have confirmed at the 31st of September this year, the amount of officers we had in Scotland was 17,265, which is 1,011 more than at 31st September 2007. Therefore, there are more police officers on the beat than previously, and there has been no decline in numbers. And as police deployment is a matter for the police in conjunction with some of the teams in the council, we should leave them to best decide how to deploy police officers.
Can I just say the police must be brilliant clairvoyants, because there's only 30 days in September. However, if they confirmed on the 31st, then good on them.
Councillor Baxter.
Thank you, Provost. I have a feeling there's a bit of motherhood and apple pie about this motion. When I read it, I agreed with it in principle, and I think everyone around this table would agree with it in principle. I think if you go out into the streets, everybody, 100% of people would agree with it. But what they wouldn't agree with necessarily is where the money's going to come from to pay for it. And that's where I do have an issue with this. I think my colleagues to my left here would agree that where the money should come from is from the £1.2 million that the Scottish Government is taking from Midlothian Council's council tax. I think where my colleagues here would also agree with me is that the money should come from the £23 million VAT that's been lost by the centralising of the police force, which equates to roughly the amount of money we're losing here. But I really need to see proposals on, because we are where we are, essentially. We went through all this discussion in the budget last year, and I voted with Labour on it because I didn't want to see the CAT teams cut. But we are where we are. We now have a position where we have a balanced budget, and we have to decide where to take the money from that. So I really do look forward to the budget proposals that hopefully will come forward from the Labour group, which will incorporate where the money is going to come from. And if they had included that in this proposal, then I think that we wouldn't have needed to take the money from reserves, as Councillor Muir had suggested, and therefore have to wait a few weeks to decide whether I should support this or not. So I'm not going to vote for the motion because I think it's incomplete, and I'm not going to vote against it because I feel that, in principle, I support it, but I would like to see where the other half of the equation is coming from.
Councillor Coventry.
Yeah, thanks, Provost. I say this with the greatest respect to Councillor Muirhead, you know, but you quoted there a raft of statistics. You know, for example, drug searches down. Has it ever occurred to you that the number of drug searches may be down because there's less drugs crime in our community? Well, the statistics bear that out. The police published, for example, in February that crime in Midlothian has fallen by 5.4%, and there was 178 fewer victims of crime. And as was reiterated earlier by my colleague, Councillor Parry, crime in Scotland is at a 42-year low. On another point, that was at £23 million VAT, am I not correct in saying that Police Scotland are the only police force in the UK that has to pay that money?
Councillor Baxter.
Sorry, if I can come back on that. Yes, you're absolutely right, Councillor Coventry, but the Scottish Government knew in advance that this would be the implication of it happening and still went ahead with it. So it cannot be said that this was an outlier that came in after the decision.
Councillor Constable.
Thank you, Provost. This funding, extra funding to the police, has been withdrawn by other authorities, notably Glasgow, and I don't believe that our citizens in Midlothian are uniquely more antisocial than any other citizens elsewhere, and that the council taxpayer should have to pick up for extra policing. I don't think Midlothian citizens are any worse than anywhere else, and therefore I don't think this motion is needed at all.
Councillor Bennett.
Thanks, Chair. It's sad that everyone's centred round about where the money's going to come from. And if you didn't believe that there's been riots in Dalkeith for the last two or three weekends, it's obviously you didn't live there. Because we, just on Friday last week, myself, Councillor Russell, Councillor Bryant, we met with the residents of Jarnock Court, most of them elderly people, and they're being terrorised in their own homes. And the police are putting all the resources they can into combat. And the motion is stating it's not about where the money's going to come from. Is if we cut police in the Midlothian with the CAT teams, which addresses this type of vandalism that's going on, and it's not happened with adults, by the way, it's for 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds, smashing windows, smashing the toilets up, Morrison's, Margot's right, Morrison's have had to put on security. I've been approached with the rugby club, the damage that's been done up there, and it's just happened over the last two or three weeks. And if we didn't address it as a council, then we're failing the people that live in Midlothian, because it's the start of something that could get bigger and bigger if we cut back on the police force, and I think we should support the motion.
Can I have a seconder for the direct negative, please? Councillor Johnson, thank you. We'll now move to the vote on this. Those in favour... Yes, you may. Yep.
Thank you. Thank you, Provost. The issue with regards to funding, obviously, has been discussed. The issue of positive destinations is something that, I mean, kind of involved in with my own area, with my own private hat on. And I know that the council does a really good job of trying to work with certain youngsters with the positive destinations. And in many cases, it probably does work. But in the last wee while, these youngsters, you know, literally rampaging around Dalkeith. And if you were at the end of a phone of someone who calls you at 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night because they're frightened to be in their own home, and they try and phone the police, they don't phone 999 because they don't feel it's an actual emergency, but they feel they want to speak to someone, so they pick the phone up and speak to myself. And there are elderly parents and elderly people in Jarnac Court area, and it does seem to be that that's the target. So for whatever reasons, I think we can know some of the reasons already, and they're being dealt with, thankfully. But that was the reason why we wanted to bring this motion here today, to try and see if we could get the CAT teams reinstated, because they do a good job, and it's something that we need. Because these youngsters, if they're not caught and dealt with, goodness alone knows what they'll get into. Thank you.
Okay, those in favour of the motion, please show.
Eight.
Those for the direct negative, please show.
Eight.
I cast my second vote in favour of the direct negative. Thank you. Item 7.3, a motion by Councillor Bennett.
Thanks, Chair. I'm conscious of the time, and I'll try and be brief as I can. As regarding the motion, it's regarding the decision that was taken last week by the Westminster Government to refuse an inquiry into the police in the Orgrave during the 84-85 Minor Strike. Now, I was doing it in Barnsley, did some work for the NEM last month, and I met some of the group for the Orgrave Justice Inquiry Group, and they were cock-a-hoop, having met Amber Rudd in London, and she told them that there would be an inquiry, but she says at this stage she didn't know what type of inquiry there would be. Accompanying the Orgrave group was the group that was involved with Hillsborough. And they made the point to Amber Rudd that they wanted an inquiry into Orgrave, but as far as they were concerned, that if action had been taken in 84-85 on the attitude of South Yorkshire Police, and then Hillsborough may never have happened. Now, nobody knows, but that was the view that they took and gave evidence to Amber Rudd. Now, what happened last Monday was it's obviously there's been a stitch-up with the establishment who have told her that you cannot called an inquiry, probably because we now know that Margaret Thatcher had her finger on the pulse because of the 30-year rule, which in 2014 showed that the police were in Downing Street took a position to control the police in Scotland. Now, that's in the minutes of the Cabinet meeting that took place in 2014. And remember, at that time, Scotland didn't have a Police Scotland. It was governed by eight police boards. And it's ridiculous that politicians in London should have been dictating the conduct to the police in Scotland. When Kemmer was happening, there was a fear that Ravenscraig was going to be shut down, so they were told to go heavy-handed. Horses weren't used at Orgrave for the first time. They were used at Ravenscraig and Hunterston. So, and even at that time, the Coal Board tried to get the strike in Scotland to be illegal, like it was a claim to be illegal by judges in England and Wales, and that failed in the High Court of Edinburgh, and the strike was official and legal in Scotland, and we've now got the legal. Just yesterday, I met with legal representatives from the NUM, and we've got a legal case to take forward. Since last week, there's two MPs in Scotland, Chris Stevens and Owen Thompson, have been in touch that they're supporting an inquiry at the police in Scotland during the strike. And I'm glad that Kelly Parry, Councillor Parry, also contacted me, that's disgusted with what was happening. And I welcome the fact, Kelly, that you're going to second this motion, because we're now getting to the stage that there's going to be a cross-party support following a launch by the miners at Newton Grange yesterday, and there'll be joint meetings with anybody that supports us, the churches, any group that supports an inquiry in the police during the miners' strike. And we've made it clear there's no compensation involved. All it's been looked for is that the truth be told, what happened during that time. And I'll leave it at that, Joe, and I'll reply to any part of the debate.
Seconded by Councillor Parry.
Thanks, Provost. I'm happy to second it, and I won't say very much either because I'm really aware of time. but I just wanted to give a wee bit of context as to my own motivations and why I'm so passionate about it. I was born just before the miners' strike, and I was only a couple of years old when most of this happened. But my family was a mining family, and they were very damaged by it. And I think there was a lot of damage done at the time. There was violence, there was physical damage done at the time. But I think emotionally and psychologically, it damaged families for a long, long time, and that damage is still there. And you know, it damaged a generation, it damaged my generation. And I found a poem which is thought to have been written by a child at the time during the miners' strike, and I thought I would read it out because I think there was a lot damage done, and I think some of those children are still feeling it. But anyway, the poem goes, "As the strike grows longer, our resolve grows stronger. Maggie thought she'd starve us back, but she couldn't be wronger." And I just thought that summed it up beautifully. One of the first things I ever done politically in my life was taking part in miners' rallies, and I was tiny. I know I'm not that much bigger now, but there I was with my banner. And so it's very, very important, I think. And one of the things that I think is really crucial is that there hasn't been any test cases go through the Scottish Criminal Cases Review Commission yet, and I think there is undoubtedly reasons why that hasn't happened, and so I think we need to investigate whether there's challenges and barriers to that. I just want to also clarify as well, just at the beginning of the motion, I know we're saying we repeat our request to the Scottish Government for a public inquiry, but could we put it on record that that will involve writing to the Scottish Government and sending them our sentiments of the motion? Thanks.
Okay. Anybody else on this motion? That carried. Okay, Councillor Bennett.
I'll just be brief. Just regarding the Scottish Criminal Case Review Commission, that's still being looked at, but there is a legal question, and I know some Queen's Councils have been... there's a difference of opinion whether it be too late, but that's still being looked at this stage.
Okay. Thank you. Does Council accept this motion? Okay, thank you. Item 7.4, a motion by Councillor Parry. Sorry, Councillor Johnson.
Thank you. Real disappointing news to hear about what's happened in the UK, Scotland, and for us in Pennycook. And I think the UK's government's disregard to transparency in their decision making about disarming Scotland in favour of promoting nuclear weapons is truly shocking. And our biggest threat is not one where we could or would retaliate with nuclear weapons today, but where conventional forces would and should be required. Terrorists, no trident wouldn't be used. And whilst we invest in these hugely expensive weapons of mass destruction, the UK government is in disinvesting in an area that would defend us against the terrorists. And that's why I propose this motion to the council, and I hope it will be accepted.
Thank you. Councillor, commentary to second.
Yeah, thanks, Provost. Yeah. The closure of Glencore's barracks will have a huge detrimental impact on servicemen and women and their families. The closure of Glencore's will also have a negative impact on the local community in Pennycook and is a huge blow to Midlothian in general. Glencore's has been a military facility for over 150 years. However, Westminster's fixation with spending billions on an obscene nuclear weapon system is leading directly to cuts to military facilities the length and breadth of the country. Therefore, I'm very happy to second the motion.
Councillor Montgomery.
Yeah, I'll be brief, Provost, because I'm very conscious of the time as well. Back in 2002, there was a threat to Glencore's barracks, a review of the UK armed forces. And I was sent in with the Midlothian Council to meet. It was Adam Ingram at the time, who was an old pal of mine for the trade unions. He was the Armed Forces Minister, and he gave me a commitment that Glencore's wouldn't be closing, and it didn't. They actually spent then £38 million refurbishing Glencore's barracks, and I find it unbelievable that just over 10, 12 years later, they're actually looking at going to be closed. I can't really get my head around that. And if there is a shortage of money in terms of reviewing barracks and bringing them up to standard where young men and women are going out fighting for their country, should be coming back and staying in the excellent facilities, and that's what Glencore has. And I think, you know, if it does go ahead and close, and let's hope there is a campaign to keep it open. And it was first built in 1803, and it has improved quite a bit since then. It was a Napoleon prisoner of war camp. It was a it was actually a military prison for a while as well. But for me, I just can't believe that £38 million could be spent between 2003 and 2005. And here we are 10, 12 years later actually looking at closing it. It just doesn't make any sense at all. And if there are other barracks that are in really poor condition, maybe they could save themselves the money and look at closing them. Well, I'm not wishing any closures in any other areas. Obviously, you've got to fight for your own part. But when Glencore was refurbished, it was seen as a quality benchmark for every other barracks in the UK, because it was the first one to get refurbished to that level. And as I say, I just think it'd be absolutely ridiculous to see it actually closing now.
Anybody else on that one? Okay, there's a... Council accept that motion. Thank you. Eventually, we arrive at item 8.3, and a review of United Kingdom Parliament constituencies in Scotland by the Boundary Commission for Scotland, a report by Kenneth Laurie, the Chief Executive.
Thank you, Provost. The Boundary Commission for Scotland published its initial proposals for UK parliamentary constituencies in Scotland on the 20th of October, starting a 12-week public consultation period that runs through to the 11th of January next year. And as set out in the report, the proposals are that the 59 current constituencies covering Scotland reduce to 53. There will be no change to the island constituencies, Western Isles and also Orkney and Shetland. But the remaining 51 constituencies must meet specific criteria set out at paragraph 2.2 in the report. In respect of Midlothian, the proposal is for the current UK Midlothian parliamentary constituency to be expanded southwards into the Scottish Borders Council area to include Ward 1, Tweeddale West, and part of Ward 2, Tweeddale East. The new constituency, it is proposed, would be named the Midlothian and Peebles County constituency. It would have an electorate of 76,208 as at 1st December last year, and maps showing this proposal are attached to the report, and a complete set of consultation documents are available for public consultation. In addition, a meeting is to be held in Edinburgh on the 7th of December to consider the proposals for this area. So really the purpose of this report is to ask the Council to consider how it wishes to respond to these initial proposals of the Boundary Commission for Scotland. Thank you, Provost.
Thank you, Mr. Laurie. Councillor Parry.
Thanks, Provost. Thanks, Kenneth. I think we should definitely respond to the consultation, and of course, grateful to have the opportunity to do so, as I'm sure we all are. But I mean, I'm perplexed by it. I think the UK government's line on it was that we would save some money by chopping some MPs of Scotland, but I think if they were really serious about saving money, they would stop increasing unelected lords, fighting illegal wars and spending an obscene amount of money on Trident. But we are where we are. I think one of the things that I noticed in terms of the review is that I'm sure in a practical term, in terms of number of electorate, number of voters, it might work, but from a geographical point of view, it just seems slightly bizarre. I don't know what the best way is to put some of that back in terms of a consultation. I think if members agree, I think we should take comments back that are come out in the chamber today, and perhaps offline as well, because I know that we are short of time and people might not want to contribute at length if people are like-minded.
Councillor Johnson.
I agree to support these recommendations that we report back, as Councillor Parry said.
Anybody else? Okay. Accept the recommendations of this report. Thank you. Item 8.4, the Financial Strategy 2017-18 to 2021-22. A report of the Head of Finance and Integrated Service Support. Mr. Fairley.
Thank you, Provost. Provost, this report provides Council with an update on the financial strategy covering next financial year 17-18 and also including projections through to 21-22. Council's agreed a timetable for the 17-18 budget cycle, which will see savings proposals presented for consideration when Council next meets on the 20th of December, with plans then to finalise the budget and to set the Council tax for 17-18 on the 7th of February next year. Today's report provides an update on key elements of the financial strategy. Firstly, in respect to the Scottish Government grant, we now expect the Government to publish its budget proposals for next year on the 15th of December, alongside individual grant settlement figures for each authority. The prospects for Government grant remain the biggest area of uncertainty to the budget, and the projections set out in the report before you continue to assume a £1 million net reduction in grant. I will report verbally to Council on the 20th when we understand the outcome of the implications of the grant settlement, and clearly that will be fully reflected in the Council report in February next year. In terms of Council tax reform, Parliament has now approved the legislative changes, and Government have also indicated that the £100 million attainment fund will be distributed on free school meals. And as such, it's anticipated that will bring £500,000 to Midlothian schools as part of that fund. Since the last report, the budget shortfall has increased slightly, as set out in Table 1, reflecting the need to provide for 25 hours class contact in primary schools. And that gives a projected shortfall, which is estimated at £10.018 million for 17-18, rising to just shy of £41 million by 21-22. That's a shortfall of 4.9%, rising to 17.6%. If we look at budgets which are currently either fixed or are challenging to reduce because of budget constraints, then the figures are a bit more significant, as set out in the report. 11% in 17-18 and potentially reaching 45% of remaining budgets by 21-22. Moving on, we've included in this report in Section 7 an indication of the resources that would be delegated to the Integrated Joint Board, and the Chief Officer and Chief Finance Officer of the IJB have been advised of these so that they can support the IJB in its own financial planning for 17-18. Then turning to Section 8, that sets out an update on the change programme, and I draw members' attention to Section 8.6, which updates Council on the development of savings options, a working draft of which were provided to the leaders of the administration, the Labour Group and Councillor Baxter on the 25th of October. Work's ongoing with the management team to refine these options, with final proposals scheduled, as I said earlier, for the 20th of December. Table 6 then sets out the latest position in terms of a budget gap to be addressed. So for next year, that's sitting just over £6 million. Section 11 gives an update for members on the available reserves, which are covered more fully in the next paper. Provost, at that point, I'll pause for any questions members may have. Otherwise, Council is asked to consider the recommendations set out in Section 14.
Councillor Parry.
Thanks, Provost. I'm happy to move the recommendations. I think much of this report is what was reported back at last Council. Just one other thing that I wanted to mention, as I know that Council Leader has sent out some notices to Opposition Leader and Independent councillors to enter into some sort of dialogue around the budget, but I would just like to say that that's open to all councillors, because I think that disagreements are good. You know, I think we're not always going to agree, and that's a good thing, but I think as we move towards a future where 1% of our council budget is going to be taken forward in a participatory budgeting process, I think it's really important for us to set out a really positive and good example as to how that we can collaborate and work well together. That's all.
Councillor Bryant.
Happy to second that, Provost.
Councillor Milligan.
Thank you for that. You can see for the paper just how hard a task this is going to be to balance the books without taking the most draconian steps in Midlothian and cutting services to the bone, or indeed stopping doing them altogether. And I would just like to thank Kenneth for at last for January supplying us with the basic information that the corporate management team's thinking at the end of October. And we look forward to a commitment here from the Chief Executive to engage once we've had time to go through the papers that he supplied, and to make sure that we have a commitment to having officers and to enter into a dialogue with each of the groups, independent councillors, etc., to clarify the thinking of the corporate management team and to bring further information along to councillors to be able to get them to understand and to be able to put forward meaningful alternatives to some of the more horrendous things that are likely to be suggested to us. We do note the budget with serious concerns, although I take Gary's word here that he's looking at the worst-case scenario and things might, depending on the Scottish Government announcement in December, might be a lot better. Let's just hope that as the old Maggie Thatcher track threatened you with the massive cuts and make it a wee bit lighter and everybody goes, shh, it's not as bad as what we thought. Let's just hope that's what this is. Let us hope that the cuts for the Scottish Government aren't as serious as what we think they are. Hopefully they'll not be. Councillor Baxter, in the earlier motion on trying to regain the police numbers for our residents and to try and keep peace, touched on the fact that we're now looking to be losing, for this tax grab, £1.2 million for the residents in Midlothian. I find it absolutely appalling, absolutely appalling. Council taxes here and should be set solely by councils. We've already had years and years and years of a gun held to our head to have to freeze council tax, and now when they're sort of saying, well, we'll let you have up to 3%, that's your lot, but by the way, we've got to come in and take massive big chunks of money for the residents in Midlothian for council tax. We're going to leave the council to collect it, we're going to then take it, and we're going to spend it on our priorities, not the priorities for the people in Midlothian. So the residents in Midlothian are going to pay £1.7 million more in council tax. That's going to be taken by the Scottish Government, and they're going to hand us £500,000 back for schools. That'll be a slice or a touch of the cuts that we'll have to hit on education to meet these draconian cuts to our budgets by the Scottish Government. They should leave council tax well alone to councils to set and to be able to collect that money and use them for priorities, and the much-needed priorities in Midlothian, and not be taking them away for their own priorities and dealing with areas. If they have these problems and have these priorities, they should raise their tax. They have the powers of demanding it. Let them use it. Didn't touch council tax. That's for councils to give to local facilities, to local schools, to local projects, and for very good causes. And we really must make sure that we make this clear to them. Therefore, whilst agreeing to note the recommendations, I would ask that we write to the Scottish Government and condemn the robbery of this £1.2 million from local council tax, and demand that any money raised through local council tax remains within the councils that are raising that tax.
Councillor Parry.
Provost, thanks. I just want to clarify one point, and that every single pound raised in council tax in Midlothian stays in Midlothian. That is a fact. And secondly, this isn't actually a paper on council tax. I think we will be having a paper on council tax next month and at February meeting, so I suggest that that's perhaps the place to raise that then.
Councillor Mulligan.
Yeah, Provost. We were kind of concerned. Councillor Parry was right out of depth when she announced at the last meeting that residents in Midlothian weren't going to lose anything out of this. It's quite clear she's completely out of depth here. This is a financial strategy. It touches on the council tax grab, and it's quite right to ask this council, and I do ask this council, that we write to the Scottish Government demanding that any money raised in council tax remain here, and that the Scottish Government didn't remove the 1.7 and then reintroduce it again as a £500,000 addition to this authority.
Okay. It's been proposed that the
the Council write to the Scottish Government. Those in favour, please show.
Ten.
Those against?
Eight.
Thank you. Well, the Council will write to the Scottish Government regarding the Council their views on the Council tax in Midlothian.
I think just for the record, Chair, also otherwise noting the terms, or again to note the terms of the report.
Okay, the report noted by the Council. Yes, thank you. Colleagues, I'm aware we've had a bit of a long day and some members may need a short comfort break. I suggest we stop for 10 minutes or so to allow that to happen. Thank you.